Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Tuesday, the 18th of February. It's been a big day in global diplomacy as the United States and Russia have held their first high-level talks since the war in Ukraine began. We read the runes in Riyadh and hear how the reset has gone down in Washington and Moscow and what it might mean for Ukraine and Europe. Also tonight, we get an update on the British couple who have been charged with espionage in Iran, hear why a crypto token is causing problems for Argentina's president, and why the governor of New York is considering removing New York City's mayor. And we consider the perils of messing with a familiar TV theme tune. The last time a US Secretary of State and their Russian counterpart attempted a major reset in the bilateral relationship, they had a prop. In 2009, Hillary Clinton presented Sergei Lavrov with a big red button with the Russian word for reset on it. Only it was the wrong word. A missing Cyrillic syllable meant the actual word written was overload. As Russia's chief diplomat undiplomatically pointed out the mistake, it seemed like a pretty bad omen. Well, today in Riyadh, there were no props as Sergei Lavrov met his latest American opposite number, Marco Rubio, just a big mahogany table dotted with displays of white flowers. And according to Mr. Lavrov, the first face-to-face meeting of its kind since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine was an opportunity for Russia to be seen and heard, but not to negotiate.
The conversation was, I think, very useful. We didn't just listen to each other, but we heard each other. And I have reasons to believe that the American party now has a better understanding of our position, that we based on numerous speeches by President Putin, and that we had an opportunity to outline in detail once again.
Secretary of State Rubio, sitting alongside his colleagues, U.S. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz and Donald Trump's roving special envoy Steve Witkoff, was asked why the Ukrainians and Europeans were not at the table.
No one is being sidelined here, but President Trump is in a position that he campaigned on to initiate a process that could bring about an end to this conflict. And from that could emerge some very positive things for the United States, for Europe, for Ukraine, for the world. But first it begins by the end of this conflict. And so the only thing President Trump's trying to do is bring about peace. It's what he campaigned on. It's something the world should be thanking President Trump for doing.
The leader who wasn't in the room where it happened, Volodymyr Zelensky, was today at least on the sidelines physically and figuratively when he spoke about the US-Russia talks on a trip to Turkey.
We want it to be fair and so that nobody decides anything behind our backs. It seems to me that this is fair. Any country has a bilateral track with other countries. Please, you can discuss anything, but you cannot make decisions without Ukraine on how to end a war in Ukraine. We were not invited to that Russian-American meeting in Saudi Arabia. It was a surprise to us, as it was, I think, to many other people. We learnt about it from the media. I don't know who's staying there or who's leaving. To be frank, I don't care.
Speaking in Mar-a-Lago in the last hour and responding to a question from the BBC, President Trump said the Ukrainians had had a seat at the negotiating table for 3 years and a long time before that. And he added a half-baked negotiator could have settled this years ago. Well, on a big day for global diplomacy, we turn to our diplomatic correspondent, James Landale. How would he assess the significance of the meeting in Riyadh?
Essentially, this is Russia coming in from the cold. This is Russia ceasing to be an international pariah. It's now America's partner. And that is an extraordinary thing because Russia is still attacking Ukraine day after day. The Russian foreign minister who was there, he is still subject to US sanctions. The Americans blame Lavrov personally alongside Putin as one of the key architects of the invasion of Ukraine. So to that extent, to see the Russians back at the table in from the cold without having to give up anything was an extraordinary sort of moment in this conflict and an astonishing gain for Team Moscow.
Wasn't just the Secretary of State and the Foreign Minister, as you say, there were teams from both sides. Did the composition of those teams tell us anything about where this goes in the short term?
I think it tells you how Team Trump operates. So Marco Rubio is the Secretary of State, but he's a former Trump rival. He's not trusted entirely by all the MAGA contingent, whereas Steve Witkoff, who was also there, who's the current special envoy for seemingly everything at the moment, he is Trump's go-to guy, his fixer, his enforcer. Also alongside him was Mike Waltz, the National Security Advisor, very tough character. they were there to sort of present a collective sort of Team Trump position. The State Department has always been seen as slightly sort of suspect by some in Team Trump. And what's interesting is in all the readouts, they were all name-checking Donald Trump. Only Donald Trump can bring peace to Ukraine. Only Donald Trump can squeeze out concessions from the Russians. But what is continuing to puzzle so many analysts in my sort of foreign policy world is why the United States is giving diplomatic concessions. You know, today, for example, they've agreed they're going to improve their own diplomatic relations. You know, more ambassadors are going to be appointed back to Washington and Moscow. In other words, you know, maybe one or two foreign intelligence officers, cunningly disguised as diplomats, will be going back into the Washington embassy. I mean, that is still continuing to puzzle people.
Still no confirmation of when a meeting mano a mano might happen between the two of them?
No, I'm not sure. It's not clear how much that was discussed today. When they were asked about this afterwards, they referred back to the fact that it was discussed during the telephone call. I think they don't want to put pressure on their own timings here. I think what they've agreed is they're going to set up negotiating teams. They'll probably appoint some special advisors and sort of, you know, SARs, if the Russians dare use that word, special representatives going to focus on this, special negotiating teams to talk about particular issues. But again, the other thing, going back to your original question, the optics of today was of Americans and Russians sat round a table, initially with the Saudis, the host, but they nipped out very, very quickly. Never a European in sight, not a Ukrainian in sight. So we had a physical manifestation of the exclusion of those other parties. However many times, you know, Marco Rubio was asked about this, and he said, well, oh, no, look, the Europeans, they got some sanctions on Russia, so at some point they're going to have to get involved into it. So in other words, the Europeans are almost going to be invited into the room to make a decision to lift sanctions when told to by the United States, and then they can leave again. Is that how it's going to work? And that is the problem at the moment, that the Europeans are struggling to find a way of making themselves relevant. Because as we saw in the meeting in Paris, there was a lot of cautious about disappearing down a rabbit hole into decisions about what military force may or may not be put on the ground to enforce a future security guarantee. And the risk of that is it opens up, well, it leaves the Europeans out of the argument for all the first important stuff, i.e. territorial concessions, nature of Ukrainian sovereignty, reparations, reconstruction, war crimes, all of that other stuff. And that's all got to be part of the mix. And so the Europeans have got to find a way of getting themselves into that discussion. What we're seeing today is the Americans and the Russians sitting together and setting up structures that are going to exclude everybody else.
Our diplomatic correspondent, James Landale. So what's the view from Moscow? Our Russia editor is Steve Rosenberg.
Very positive. I mean, just watching the news bulletins on state television, they're very happy with the way things have gone. They're talking about an historic day, this new relationship between Russia and the United States. I mean, this is the first time since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine that US-Russian officials have sat face-to-face and talked business. And that's a big deal here, because for the last 3 years, Western governments have tried to isolate Russia, to punish Russia for invading Ukraine. You remember those thousands of sanctions that were imposed on Russia? 3 years on, what do we see? We see Russia continuing to wage war against Ukraine, and yet senior US officials are happy to sit down at the negotiating table and talk to senior Russian officials. And that is being presented here in Russia as a diplomatic victory.
Realism, though, too, in Russia? Do they think this, you know, for all Donald Trump's talk of wanting to get this through quickly, they are the ones in a pretty strong position when it comes to the battlefield?
You know, there is this definite sense of confidence here in Russia at the moment. Now they feel they're gaining territory and they have the initiative on the battlefield. But also that confidence is driven by the kind of comments that the Trump administration has been coming out with in recent days. Most of what US officials have been saying has been music to Moscow's ears. Things like, it's unrealistic to think that Ukraine could join NATO. It's unrealistic to think that Ukraine could go back to the pre-2014 borders, that there'll be no US boots on the ground as part of a peacekeeping force or security guarantees. All of that goes down very well here.
They are talking about deals. They're talking about huge amounts of money. The Russians are saying that the Americans have lost out by businesses pulling out of Russia. So there is a pretty hefty financial aspect to this as well.
Yeah, absolutely there is. I mean, at the table, the negotiating table, we saw two Russian diplomats, and that was it. So Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, and Vladimir Putin's foreign policy advisor. Now, behind them, there were other members of the delegation who, yes, were talking business, were talking money. People like Kirill Dmitriev, the head of a sovereign wealth fund. And the American delegation basically said, if we can get the war in Ukraine solved, then there are so many possibilities that open up between Russia and America, economic, financial opportunities for cooperation, geopolitical cooperation too was talked about. So the priority now is to stop the war in Ukraine. And then, as far as Washington is concerned, this new relationship with Russia can really get going.
It's not going to be just flicking a switch, though, is it? I mean, the Russians are making it clear, certainly at the moment, that they are going to stick with their demands, perhaps even ratchet some of them up.
Yeah, I mean, you don't really hear the word compromise being expressed by Russian officials at the moment. When you ask them, you know, what kind of a deal are they willing to do, they continue to point you back to what Vladimir Putin said in June of last year, the so-called Putin peace proposal, which actually reads more like an effort to get Ukraine to capitulate. Basically, what Russia wants is all the territory it has seized so far in Ukraine, plus a little bit more. It wants Western sanctions to be scrapped. It doesn't want Ukraine going into NATO. And in fact, today it said it actually strengthened that demand. It said it wanted NATO to come out and formally disavow the promise that it had made in 2008 that Ukraine could at some point join the NATO alliance.
I was listening to a bit of Russian news earlier, and they're talking about the two superpowers sitting down and talking to each other as if, you know, the post-Cold War years had never existed almost.
I mean, this is what Vladimir Putin wants, right? I mean, he sees Russia as a great power. A few years ago, when President Obama described Russia as a regional power, that really hurt. He sees his country as a great power that should be sitting at the top table of global politics, rubbing shoulders with the American president and deciding the affairs of the world. You know, he thinks back to Yalta, the Yalta conference at the end of the Second World War, Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin sitting there side by side, basically deciding the post-war order. And I think that's what Russia wants now. It wants a second Yalta. It wants a big summit where the president of America, the president of Russia can get together and decide on a new international order.
Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, there. Well, today's meeting in Riyadh is just the latest chapter in what's been a long and twisting history of US-Russian relations since the end of the Cold War. Let's just have a listen back to some of the key moments from the American side.
I looked the man in the eye. I found it to be very straightforward and trustworthy. We had a very good dialogue. I was able to get a sense of his soul.
We want to reset our relationship.
And let's do it together.
So we will do it together, okay?
Russia is a regional power that is threatening some of its immediate neighbors, not out of strength, but out of weakness.
And to continue to urge every member in this room to stand up to Vladimir Putin. He's a thug.
Well, you may have recognized President George W. Bush after meeting Vladimir Putin in Slovenia in 2001, the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and her attempt to reset relations with Russia with that famous reset button wrongly translated into Russian. There was President Obama in 2014 and finally President Biden in 2022. Listening to that and joining us now, Andrew Weiss. He worked at the US State Department under Presidents Clinton and George Bush Sr. He was Director for Russian, Ukrainian and Eurasian Affairs on the National Security Council staff and is now at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Good evening.
Great to be here.
What did you think when you saw those images from Riyadh of Secretary of State Rubio shaking hands with Foreign Minister Lavrov?
I think we're witnessing a remarkable change since President Trump took office just a few weeks ago. And what we're seeing is a tearing hurry. And this White House now seems to think that if you rush and you do high-profile meetings, you can solve the problems in Ukraine. It would be nice if they were right in that theory of the case. Unfortunately, this is a war that's dragged on now for more than 10 years. And the issues at the heart of it are really, really hard to solve. And the question, and I think it really sort of turns on this, is has the United States under President Trump decided that it has different interests at stake? Up to this point, U.S. Presidents have believed that the U.S. actually had a lot at stake. It's not clear yet if that's the case with President Trump.
So when you say something different as a priority or different at stake, what might that be then if it's not what was the priority before?
So the reality here is that Russia, for no practical benefit, decided to invade its neighbor to try to decapitate its political leadership, and to push Ukraine back into Russia's sphere of influence through force of arms. That failed spectacularly. The people of Ukraine rallied in their defense, and they've been fighting now for more than 10 years to defeat Russian aggression. In the process, Russia has committed unspeakable war crimes and atrocities on Ukraine's soil. President Putin was indicted on war crimes charges by the International Criminal Court. So this is a very different Russia we're dealing with. Instead, today, when we look at Secretary Rubio and the other senior U.S. officials who are with him in Riyadh, they talk about, you know, restarting U.S.-Russia cooperation. They suggest that there's big potential payoff in geopolitical terms or in economic terms from that kind of a relationship. And it just seems to sort of turn the page on everything I was just talking about. That is a major change.
And turn it to what, though? I mean, there's a lot of talk at the meeting, it would seem, about business opportunities, the Russian delegation suggesting that U.S. corporations had lost $300 billion dollars by withdrawing from Russia after the invasion. Do you think that's what the Trump administration is looking at as common ground?
It seems very much that way. And the terms in which the U.S. officials spoke today were very laudatory, as if there's this big, you know, set of financial or economic and geopolitical benefits that could be derived from resuming U.S.-Russian cooperation. These are similar concepts that the Russians trotted out in front of the Trump team during the presidential election in 2016, the presidential transition in 2016 and 2017. And there was a similar kind of focus on, well, maybe we can team up, in Trump's words, to knock the hell out of ISIS in Syria, or we could peel Russia away from China. Those are you know, very alluring ideas, and it would be great if they were true. Unfortunately, they're not.
So you don't think there is common ground between the two countries?
I think the United States and Russia have common issues they need to address. Ukraine is where, you know, you would start. It's going to be really hard. But at the same time, the United States and Russia should be able to compartmentalize some of their differences and work, for example, to reduce their nuclear arsenals. They should be able to work together to deal with climate change or other major issues on the international agenda. So far, the Russians have held those issues hostage and have tried to say, until you get out of Ukraine, or you stop backing Ukraine, we can't deal with you on these other issues.
Andrew Weiss, former U.S. State Department official, thanks very much. And coming up later on in the program,
it's part of people's, not just their recognition factor of these programs, but it's almost part of their kind of security. One of the big things about a TV theme, it's got to tell people who are out in the kitchen, this program's starting, you like it.
Well, look at the risks of revamping a TV theme tune.
So Winterbury's eating the local delicacy, which, who knew, is potato and egg mixed together.
Look how beautiful Iran is. We are here.
Just some of the social media videos shared by the British couple Craig and Lindsay Foreman from their travels in Iran. Last week it emerged that they had been arrested in the southern city of Kerman in January. And today an Iranian news agency gave an update on their fate. I've been hearing more from our World Affairs correspondent Caroline Hawley.
there was a report from an Iranian news agency affiliated with the Iranian judiciary, and a spokesman for the judiciary was quoted in that as saying that the couple have now been charged with espionage. He said that they had been under surveillance when they were picked up in the city of Kerman. He accused them of only posing as tourists, of gathering information in several provinces, and being in touch with institutions with connections with, as he put it, hostile and Western intelligence services.
Anything from Craig and Lindsay's families?
Not today. There has been a statement from the Foreign Office saying that it is deeply concerned by reports that they've been charged with espionage. I don't think it's been officially informed of the charges. And I think the families are kind of waiting to see how this plays out. They said on Saturday, when they named the couple being held as Craig and Lindsay, they said it was a very distressing situation and they were clearly aware of the complexities of the case. We know quite a lot more about what they were doing. We know that they were on a motorbike tour of the world. They were heading for Australia. She's a life coach. They were presenting some research, or she was, at a conference on positive psychology. They saw themselves as being on a mission. They called it a mission chatting to people about what it means to live a good life and collecting, they said, messages of goodwill for the world. And they posted a lot about their travels through Turkey, through Armenia and in Iran, quite a lot about how much they were liking Iran, how they liked the food, how warm and welcoming the people were. Lindsay Foreman had posted a picture of herself on the 3rd of January. That was the last day her family heard from her, meeting a cleric in the town of Isfahan. And on Instagram, she wrote, "Travel continues to teach me that humanity's core is shared kindness, humility, respect for one another." So they were clearly having a good time. They had visas for Iran. They had a tour guide. I think they didn't think they were doing anything controversial. They were aware of the travel advice, which is pretty strong. The Foreign Office advises British nationals not to travel to Iran. It says that just having a British passport can be enough to get you detained.
Is there a precedent for this kind of arrest, for people being arrested in these circumstances?
Certainly, over the past few years, dozens of people, foreigners or people holding foreign passports, have been detained, often on vague security charges. And human rights groups say they are being held for leverage so that Iran can make a deal, make a transaction, get something in return. It's called hostage diplomacy, and Iran is fairly adept at it. There was a case a few years ago in 2019 of an Australian couple. They were travel bloggers. They'd used a drone and they were accused of espionage again, I think, of filming near a military installation, and they were released. I think Australia denied that there was a deal, but the Iranians said that an Iranian student was released, and so it has been reported there was an exchange. And then if we look closer to home at the case of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, who is also accused of acting against the interests of Iran, and she was held for more than 5 years, and she was not released until the UK repaid a long-standing military debt that brought her home and another British national, Anousheh Ashoori.
BBC's Caroline Hawley. He has been praised for his chainsaw approach to his country's chronic inflation, but the Argentine president, Javier Milei, is now facing calls for his impeachment after he praised an unknown cryptocurrency token which subsequently crashed in value. In a post on X on Friday, Mr. Milei said the token, called Libra, would stimulate the economy. He later deleted his post and wrote that he had not been familiar with the details of the project when he had promoted it. It is just the latest example of a so-called meme coin. To find out exactly what that means and how it's gone wrong in this case, I spoke to Nick Carter, a partner at the crypto investment firm Castle Island Ventures.
Last Friday, I believe at 5 p.m., Malay tweeted out a link to a meme coin contract address, and that caused an immediate burst of activity. You know, the market capitalization of this thing rose to about $4 billion within an hour, and then it proceeded to collapse. And of course, then questions started to emerge as to the nature of this project. And it soon became clear that this had been front run, and there had been basically insider trading that occurred. And now, of course, Milei is dealing with the considerable fallout and there's a huge amount of consternation in kind of the crypto space over this too.
Well, for those who aren't in the crypto space, you might have to explain what a meme coin is, just in simple terms, if you could.
A meme coin is effectively a cryptocurrency that doesn't promise anything. It doesn't really claim to have any fundamental value whatsoever. It just trades on a concept, you know, like it doesn't have any reason it should be worth anything. It is effectively a form of gambling, for lack of a better term. These have been enormously popular in the crypto space over the last year. I mean, they've been around for over a decade, but there's been a huge amount of activity in the meme coin space over the last year.
And Mr. Milei is not the only head of state to dabble in them.
That's right. I mean, Trump infamously launched one actually on a Friday evening a few weeks back. And also the president of the Central African Republic, I believe, launched one. So yeah, he's in good company.
So what is behind this? What is it? Is it personal benefit for the person who launches one?
Yeah, certainly that could be it. The premise of a meme coin is actually, well, generally speaking, that these are quote unquote fair in the sense that oftentimes the teams behind them did not have a large share of the supply. But of course, if you launch them, there are ways to profit from the kind of prior knowledge that there's going to be a launch. And that appears to have been the case here with the team behind this meme coin. Seems to have traded on the launch and made actually over $100 million, as far as we can tell. I think the question now is, was this just a kind of an honest mistake from Milei? Was he receiving bad advice? Did someone in his inner circle take advantage of him to use his platform to launch this? Or did he or his affiliates or his circle actually profit from this? In which case, the investigation takes on a much more serious tenor.
You talk of seriousness. Meme coins, as I understand it, started out as a bit of a joke, didn't they? Have they changed then over the years?
Of course, yeah. So arguably the first meme coin was Dogecoin back in 2013. These were just considered playful projects without much significance for a long time. But over time, it became a huge money pit. I mean, people put billions and billions of dollars into these meme coins and made billions of dollars, and the whole space became very industrialized. And now there are professional teams that launch these meme coins and trade on them and use bots to trade on them early, ahead of the human traders. And so it started out playful, but it became, you know, it's a serious commercial enterprise. I'm kind of disappointed by the frenzy of activity in meme coins. We invest in startups in the crypto space, certainly nothing in the meme coin sector. It's a distraction at best. And, ultimately, it's retail investors that buy these things that lose money. You know, it's kind of like a casino game where the house has a 90% edge as opposed to 50-50.
Nick Carter, a partner at the crypto investment firm Castle Island Ventures. Now, the governor of New York State, Kathy Hochul, is weighing up whether to do something that no New York governor has done before. Should she sack New York City's Mayor Eric Adams over her concern for the stability of the city? Mayor Adams, who, like the governor, is a Democrat, has been facing some fairly serious corruption charges. And last week, after appealing to the Trump administration, he was suddenly offered a lifeline when the Justice Department dropped the charges. Tyler Foggett is a senior editor at New Yorker magazine and has been following the story. Good evening.
Hi, how's it going?
Going well, thanks. So for our listeners who might not have followed this, what are the types of charges that Adams has been facing?
So last year, Adams was indicted for various things. We've got bribery charges, fraud, illegal foreign campaign donations. So it's a whole slew of things.
And why has he been getting friendly? Is a Democrat been getting friendly with Donald Trump and the administration?
Well, it seems like it's because the Trump administration has something that they can offer Adams, which is a way out of this terrible mess. So one thing that's interesting here is, basically there was this deal that was made where the Justice Department would drop the charges against Adams. Their justification was that It was because the charges were getting in the way of Adams's ability to execute on Donald Trump's agenda to crack down on illegal immigration in New York City. And the Justice Department has requested that Adams's case be dismissed without prejudice, which basically means that the Trump administration can also reinstate the charges if they choose to. And so as a result, you have a situation where Adams is getting something out of the Trump administration, but also if he doesn't give them his part of it, which is that he will, you know, help with this mass deportations plan that Trump has, you know, sort of designed, then there's a chance that he will be in legal trouble again, which is sort of a situation that a lot of people have been referring to as just a total quid pro quo.
And the governor then is facing this this dilemma to go where no governor has gone before. Is there any indication of which way she is going to go?
Not that I know of so far. I mean, I think the fact that she has made the move to call this meeting of the inability committee is what they call it to discuss Adams's removal. I mean, that alone seems like a pretty big step, just because there were, you know, as soon as the charges were brought against Adams, there was a discussion of whether Hochul might use this power to remove Adams from office. And only now is she actually considering wielding it. So, yeah, I mean, it's a pretty unprecedented moment. This power hasn't been used in New York's 235-year history. So the fact that it's even being discussed makes me think that there's a good chance that something will happen here. But we have not heard yet what the committee has decided, essentially.
Tyler, many thanks. We'll keep an eye on that story. There's been some interesting mayors of New York in the past, and the current one proving to be interesting as well. Tyler Foggett there from The New Yorker. Now, it has been one of the most eagerly anticipated television events of the year, certainly in our household. The third series of the award-winning American black comedy White Lotus began at the weekend with, as fans would expect, a new luxury resort setting and a largely new cast. What many of them didn't expect, or indeed welcome, was the largely revamped theme tune. It's led to the sort of outrage on social media that the show's entitled characters might display if their sheets in their hotel room aren't turned down to their liking. And I've been discussing the rights and wrongs of changing theme tunes with the composer, writer and broadcaster Neil Brand. But first, how important is a theme tune to a television series?
It's part of people's, not just their recognition factor of these programs, but it's almost part of their kind of security. One of the big things about a TV theme, it's got to tell people who are out in the kitchen, this program's starting, you like it. So it's got to have a memorability to it. It's got to have a hook. And then on top of that, it's got to sound pretty similar every time that episode comes back in the series, or each time the series comes back. So that always there's a branding to it, but it's one where people kind of go, ah, great, you're home, come on, you know you like this, sit you down, everything's going to be like it was 25 years ago.
So that is why playing about with theme tunes, tweaking them, is something that has to be done with care?
Oh, yes. Usually it is, I have to say. If you go on YouTube, rather wonderfully, you can actually hear all of the Doctor Who themes from the early 60s till now. It's really carefully and thoughtfully planned through. So when you hit the kind of 1970s into the 80s, when it's a little bit more electronic, it's a little bit more disco, it's a bit more sort of New York Studio 54, that is because that's the feeling at the time. That was the period. When you move on to the most recent version, Chris Eccleston coming in, you know, just after the 2000s, then you've got the orchestra. You've got the National Orchestra of Wales in there as well. Basically, it doesn't only bring it through the kind of social development that's been going on. It also brings it through a kind of sense that it's an upgrade. It's not just a repeat. It's even better this time than it was last time.
So the theme tune that's caused all the fuss over the last couple of days, the White Lotus theme tune. So The first two series, it's a similar theme, but they've slightly changed it because the key to the show is each season is in a set in a different country. This time they have gone a bit further than a lot of fans like.
They have, and that's been a problem. I could see how it works, because the first season had got the theme tune, it got a real ethnicity to it, but really interesting vocalising as well. second theme, they were in Italy, and suddenly you had an operatic feel to it, but still keeping those kind of claps and those vocalizations. This third one now that has come, obviously it's changing with the mise-en-scene of each of the series. The theme is sort of there, but it's gone much, much darker, and I think people have been put off by the fact that suddenly it's beginning to sound like a dance piece. This is starting to sound a little bit generic.
And can fiddling around with a theme like this actually be terminal for a franchise?
I wouldn't have thought so. The plain fact of the matter is that no one is going to mess around with a theme that works. And if it's working, you'll probably find it'll be back in so many different ways. I mean, you take something like The Wire. All the angels sing about you. It's basically the same number, which has been there the whole time, Down in the Hole by Tom Waits. But season one was the Blind Boys of Alabama singing it. Next one was Tom Waits. Next one was the Neville Brothers. So it was changed each time, but it was the same number. And this is what tends to happen with very, very long-run TV series. The one difference, I feel, with regular TV is with news and current affairs, because the music changes entirely as the years go by with news and current affairs. It's still doing the same job, which is actually bringing an urgency into your house. And so that has changed in the same way as the Doctor Who theme has changed with society over the years. But in almost every other case, no one is going to destroy a theme that is working really, really well and replace it with something nobody knows. That would be absolute disaster.
We do it all without music, of course, here on Radio 4.
Absolutely.
And that was the writer and broadcaster Neil Brand. Closing headline tonight, Donald Trump has said he's no problem with European countries such as the UK sending peacekeeping forces to Ukraine, despite Russia rejecting the proposal. And one thing to tell you before we leave you, Rick Buckler, the drummer with the new wave greats The Jam, has died at the age of 69. He played with the band that led, of course, by Paul Weller from 1972 until they broke up a decade later. They had four number ones, including Eton Rifles. And that is The World Tonight. I'm James Kamara-Sami. For now, from me and from everyone here on the programme, have a very good night.